Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, everyone, and welcome back to the New Books Network and New Books in Russian and Eurasian Studies. I'm your host today, Stephen Siegel, and it's my great pleasure to speak with two eminent historians, Professor Valerie Kivelson and Professor Christine Vorobets, who are the authors of a new book called Witchcraft in Russia and Ukraine, 1000 to 1900, a source book. They are the editors of this book, published by Cornell University Press 2020. So thank you, Val, and thank you, Christine, for joining me on the podcast today.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you, Stephen.
So at this difficult and dark time, I want to say a few words about their biographies. Valerie Kivelson teaches at the University of Michigan, where she is the Thomas N. Tentler Collegiate Professor and Arthur F. Turnow Professor of History. She is a corresponding fellow of the British Academy. Her publications include Russia's Empires 2016, co-authored with Ron Suni, Cartographies of Tsardom, The Land and Its Meanings in 17th Century Russia, 2006, a book which really inspired me, and of course, the one we'll be talking about today on witchcraft. Her current projects include a monograph on Icons of Empire, Imagery and Imperial Expansion in Early Modern Russia. Christine Vorobets, her biography, with the generous support of the NEH, Institute of Advanced Studies in Paris, Alexandre Institute at the University of Helsinki, and Open Society Institute. Professor Vorobets is the Distinguished Research Professor Emerita at Northern Illinois University. She has published widely on 19th century Russian and Ukrainian peasants, women and gender issues, and religious history. Her monographs, Peasant Russia, Family and Community in Post-Emancipation Russia, 1991, and Possessed, Women, Witches, and Demons, 2001, have both won the Helt Prize of AWSS. She has received the 2008 Association for Slavic Women's Studies Outstanding Achievement Award and the 2017 Association for Slavic, East European, and Eurasian Studies Distinguished Contribution Award. So I really want to get right to the content of this book. And for both of you, if I may, I'll start with a general question about your motivation, what drew you to this topic, and how you got started.
Well, Christine and I both have been working on witchcraft in this part of the world for several decades, number of decades. For me personally, I kind of fell into the topic by an unexpected archival finding when I was working on an altogether unrelated topic. I was working on provincial politics and found records of a large witchcraft case, which just immediately drew my interest. And the topic as we've both discovered, is a fabulously productive one for historians, because it gets us into recesses of people's lives that are usually inaccessible. The innermost recesses of peasants and women and illiterate people, and into their emotional lives. And it also opens up really productive avenues for comparative history. So all of those, I think, were part of the attraction. Christine?
I came to the subject matter as a comparative historian. After working on a book on Russian peasants, I wanted to explore the general topic in the late 19th century, early 20th century for Ukrainian peasants living in the Russian Empire. And in doing so, I was also attracted by topics concerning religion. And the ethnographic material that had been written about in the 19th century really concentrated on demonology. And I thought, oh, this was a great topic. But as I got into the literature, I realized that it was skewed, that we would just be repeating all sorts of names of demons and how they were so colorful and so on. But I wanted to know what was happening on the ground. And I began then to look for instances of witchcraft in both the Russian and Ukrainian villages. And this means very disparate villages throughout both the Russian-speaking areas and Ukrainian-speaking areas, as well as mixed villages and so on. And I came across references to klykushestva, demon possession, in Russian areas and not in Ukrainian areas. And that really intrigued me. And that began then a study of witchcraft. This goes back to, about 1999, and have been working on it ever since. And as a comparative scholar, I am very much convinced that by comparing historical experiences in Russian areas and Ukrainian areas provides just a wonderful window onto the similarities as well as the major differences amongst these areas. And it's not for nationalistic reasons or for some kind of inherent brotherhood existing between these two nations. It's trying to figure out, in essence, what is happening on the ground. And it also explores where there are silences. So the absence of klykushestva in Ukrainian areas suggests now that may have been something that was deliberate. I'm now finding some cases where monasteries in Ukraine sent klykushi away, for example, from the Pcherska Lavra to other monasteries in Ukraine. And so I'm interested in how religion was practiced by worshipers at all levels of society.
Well, thank you. I think that's a really good jumping off point for many of the questions that I've noted in reading through this as a source book. So my first big question for Val is, really, given your work on centers and peripheries, on cartography and visual evidence and sources, I wonder if you could explain to our listenership your procedures in collecting some of this evidence. If you had in mind a certain geography, or if you had in mind a way of conceptualizing this early modern relationship between the centers and the peripheries in your study of witchcraft.
Interesting. So I think, to be honest, when I started, which Christine, you surprised me with 1999. I guess I started over a decade earlier in the 80s working on this material. And quite honestly, I was less aware of peripheries at that time. I think scholarship was so Russian-centric at that time. But as I continued, so what I did was I poured through all of the documents of the central Muscovite judicial chancelleries and found any trace of witchcraft that I could find. Similarly with the 18th century material, which our colleagues had worked on, really using those central Muscovite and Petrine Petersburg archives. But as time went on, my thinking along with the field really changed, really opened up. And as I got interested in Siberia, especially, I turned to look for witchcraft trials in other parts of the country, of the empire. Siberia, as a periphery, turns out to be very interesting because it has its own occult traditions or religious traditions in shamanism and other modes of practice. And the trials pretty carefully differentiate witchcraft from shamanism. For Ukraine, the cases were hard for me to access because of language. And our colleagues have really, well, Christine and our other colleagues have really made that piece accessible, which has been a huge boon.
Yeah, I see, because I'm always attentive to maps, that there is a map, both which I would describe in the Russian case, or maybe in the Petrine case from Muscovy, and then there's an early modern map of Ukrainian lands, which I think does really well in stretching the book both geographically and time-wise through right bank Ukraine and left bank Ukraine. So I think that is one of my compliments to you in really, I think, devising this as a history covering 900 years of both Russia and Ukraine.
Stephen, could I jump in on the map?
Please,
sorry to
please.
Cut you off, but I agree. I think we agree. Those maps are so helpful in reminding us of the complicated, multicultural histories and entanglements, especially of the Ukrainian lands, and do a lot of visual work. And we want to thank Carl Longstreth, who made those maps for us here at the University of Michigan.
Yeah. Thank you. And for Christine, I have a slightly different question for you, and we'll begin to kind of combine this in the layout of the book as my follow-up. But I'm very interested in how you brought together not just the history of Ukraine, but also the history of magic and ritual from Poland, Lithuania, from within these multicultural, multi-ethnic spaces. And I guess if you could respond to that, my question for you would be how you found points of intersection between legal and religious history. I think there are a lot of really big surprises that we might be able to talk about gender-wise in the book in terms of how witchcraft is treated. But I am really fascinated in how you read the many, many volumes of legal history into the individual cases of witchcraft across this multicultural, multi-ethnic space.
Well, some of this was pioneering work in that having worked in legal documents having to do with Russian peasant villages in the post-emancipation period, I did not come across cases of witchcraft, but I was really interested in local court systems, what happened in the Volos court, for example. And there were Volos courts in areas of Ukraine and the Russian Empire as well. But as we broached this comparative perspective of Ukrainian and Russian witchcraft, I certainly had been dependent initially on ethnographic reports, which are very different than legal documents and understanding legal structures. And so in putting together this source book, we had to do quite a bit of original research in trying to uncover, in essence, what Saxon law was like, because Saxon law and various other Germanic laws were really part of the Ukrainian experience. And that is very different. Magdeburg law, really investigating it, to see, reading the law codes that were peculiar, and I use that word in a positive way, that were unique to the Ukrainian case that were absent in the Russian case, where Roman law, Germanic law does not prevail. And then we had the other major problem. I have been studying for the last 20 years a new courts that was set up by Catherine the Great, these conscience courts, or that allowed witchcraft to be adjudicated in a space where actual written law could be amended and mitigated and become more humane and not prosecute witchcraft so dramatically. And that took quite a bit of work beyond. Yeah, Val and I, we rewrote those sections repeatedly, and just figuring out how the system worked was extremely complicated. And for those of our scholars who work on Petrine Russia, that was an opaque area as well. And so we had to do a lot of original research. And I think we've made a good step forward. We have a lot of material on how the legal processes work. And the two societies are extremely different. In the Ukrainian case, even when Ukrainian lands became a part of the Russian Empire, Ukrainian law, based on Magdeburg, Saxon law, continued to be allowed and is not really subjugated until near the end of the 18th century, but obviously still had resonance within the societies.
Yeah, I want to return to some of the points that both of you just made. But if I may, as a kind of intermezzo for our listeners, I will say that the book is so extensive. It's divided not only into chapters, but it also covers parts. So part one is called Historical Evolution, Law and Prosecution, with four chapters. Part two is Magical Practices, Everyday Matters, and the Power of Words, trial excerpts, also covering several chapters. And I think, if I may ask both of you, I would really like to turn to the history of gender within this book, and to how the charges, or at least maybe even the imagination of witches, how they are accused legally and extra-legally, how loyalty oaths are intended, right? And you know, sort of like how you're looking back to some of the classic documents of Russian history, like the Kerbsky correspondence. My question really for you would be, for our listenership, if you could tell us maybe what some of the surprises have been about your findings as you've poured through these records. Who wants to take that?
Christine wants to take that.
Well, thank
there
you,
are
Val.
Surprises. Go. Deference is key.
There were a lot of surprises. And so what I have to say from the outset is that Val and I felt as if we were starting from scratch again, that yes, we knew a lot, but boy, did we not know a lot. And as we were looking at not only documents that we have read previously any number of times, and the Kerbsky, for example, Grozny correspondence, rereading it with a mindset of what witchcraft is all about, we were really struck by the way in which all ranks groups within early modern Russian society were captivated by magic. And when, you know, we used to talk about political witchcraft as something that was specific to the upper classes or were specific to any individual who may have made an aspersion against the crown, that is a very old-fashioned way of thinking. The political was everywhere. As people are trying to understand their relationship to authority, and people are protesting serfdom, they're reacting to, and serfdom comes gradually in the Muscovite lands, starting in the late 16th century and moving into obviously the 17th century and so on. But political relationships are through, you know, prevail through all aspects of society. But I was totally astonished in translating and coming across the loyalty oaths to the Tsar. And we begin with the oath that was given to Boris Godunov. And the language is full of magic and evil that can be thrust upon not only the Tsar, but his family and any progeny. And it continues in loyalty oaths through the 17th century in slightly different formats. The actual oaths to Godunov and Shuisky have magic in the actual oath, whereas under first two Romanovs, we have a more standardized, I suppose, oath, but there are oaths given by anyone in the Tsar's household or the Tsarina's household that are full of references to magic. And these are, servitors had to provide oaths that said that they would protect the Tsar and his family from any kind of evil, herbs, curses. It's full of very detailed language about witchcraft practices that we see on the ground in villages. So the widespread aspect of this witchcraft is really quite astounding, and it lingers into the 18th century. And so that one finding was so exciting. But when it comes to something like religion, we have a Polish case, or excuse me, a Ukrainian case set in area of Ukraine, in which we have a man who is turned to by a cleric's wife for exorcism. And the house, there's description of the house and how this exorcist goes about protecting the house against demons and the devil's work. And I read that I don't know how many times until I had to write up the introduction to that particular example. And I realized quite suddenly that there were lots of borrowings from church services, the use of a censer, for example, but also the baptismal rite. And it dawned on me all of a sudden. It was like the light bulb went on. And we had lots of light bulbs like that.
Yeah.
Where all of a sudden we realize something.
there are so many rich stories that you have out of the demonological literature, you know, to really diverge from the stereotypes that Western scholars or scholars of Western Europe might have about men and women and witchcraft. And that was striking to me, just reading through all of the meticulous evidence that you've collected, and as you say, about the efficacy of magic through the late 18th century. Val, I want to give you a chance to answer this in your own voice. So in all the records that you searched through, maybe, you know, involving 900 people or 500 trials, what were the big surprises that you drew out of the early modern period?
Yeah, I think the way that magic so profoundly structured politics was surprising, that it wasn't peripheral. We were talking about peripheries earlier. It wasn't an add-on, but it reflected really the fundamental structuring of society. There's a historian, a scholar who works on witchcraft in South Africa today, named Adam Ashforth, and he describes a state of spiritual insecurity that causes people to look for magical explanations of daily life, of politics, of the world around them. And I think that really emerged powerfully for me, looking at the sum total of these cases. And even when we don't expect magical thinking anymore in the High Enlightenment, for instance, or in the 19th century, there's a way in which that mode of thinking and explanation comes through across the board. So I think that was one of the big surprises. Another more intellectually particular matter for me was the materiality of magic that came through. So Christine was talking about the loyalty oaths. In those oaths, they're detailed descriptions of the things one shouldn't put in particular places. So one shouldn't tie amulets to the manes of horses, and one shouldn't put grasses in the bedding. So the way in which the spiritual insecurity takes material form, I found really fascinating. And we keep finding more and more little tidbits that we wish we could put back into the book about the meanings of, we were just talking about milk and honey, which are standard parts of love charms and are prohibited in penitentials. So the way that perfectly ordinary, everyday stuff of life objects can be imbued with magical power and magical danger was really striking to me.
Yeah. And there's so much work, you know, I think, that is being done, really interesting ways on materiality and material culture. I hope in many ways that work on the late Soviet period can be informed by this, because I see actually so many parallels across time and space. I did want to ask a question about church codes and written law. So I think sometimes when I'm teaching my pre-modern course, for lack of a better word, or East Slavic world course, about the sudebniks and what is actually, you know, in the content of not just the sudebnik, but also the conciliar law code and church codes. Could you maybe, for our audience of general listeners here on New Books Network, talk a little bit about the transformation in the 17th century, or from, let's say, the 16th, 17th century to 18th century under Peter the Great? What happens to this law code? I mean, what actually happens to the sudebnik, the uloženje, in terms of witchcraft? Because I see this as a really important dividing line one way or another for the way scholars treat the question of secularization and Westernization, or maybe don't get the full picture of that, if that's a fair question. So to either of you, please.
So I'm not exactly sure where the question was leading in terms of secularization, but let me talk a little bit and then tell me if I've addressed your question. So again, one of the discoveries that we made when we looked at all of the laws together, you know, we both knew these laws, but there's something in the process of examining them the way one does for a collection like this that casts them in a new light. It became clear to us that witchcraft legislation was spotty, erratic, inconsistent. It's not reflected at all in the two sudebniki, Ivan III sudebnik or Ivan IV sudebnik. It doesn't show up really in the 1649 Uloženje. It's sort of indirectly imputed, but there are a welter of laws and decrees and quotations from Byzantine law that show up on the side. They characterize witchcraft in different ways. And of course, Magdeburg law and the Lithuanian statute also have their own conceptions in the Ukrainian lands.
But very brief. They're incredibly brief. And one of the things you have to realize is witchcraft was perceived to be so dangerous, they had to burn the spells and so on. They didn't keep because they were perceived to be extremely dangerous. So sometimes you have references to witchcraft without using the word. It was perceived in and of itself to be dangerous. And I think this is something that really has to be emphasized.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that answers my question really well, because I'm thinking about, sometimes the typical way of teaching about sorcery or the causes of evil. I actually wondered if you could shift a little bit away from law and religion to the ethnographic parts of this book as you collected sources. So could you tell us or tell me about which sources you see as somehow central, if that makes any sense, for getting at this issue of bewitchment? And by that, I simply mean the accusations and punishment, because it seems to change a lot under Catherine the Great with a rationalist understanding of the world. But maybe give us an idea of the sources that you see for magic and bewitchment and punishment that you would find useful for our students.
Well, I think if this retains a focus on law, but if we look at the shift from the late 17th century to Peter the Great and then to Catherine, we see real changes in the conceptualization of witchcraft and magic and possession in particular. And that, of course, is Christine's bailiwick. But Peter is known for completely switching the ethical, the positive negative valence of possession, and coding shriekers, kikushi, as fakers, leveling false accusations. And he's very harsh on them. But it's not that he stops believing in witchcraft. So in his military articles, he introduces for the first time in Russian law a sense that magic might be derived from a pact with the devil. There were a few cases involving pacts with the devil earlier, but it wasn't entrenched in the law, and he's the one who does that. So it's a really surprising mix there. It's only with Catherine that the whole shebang gets coded as fakery. And so practicing witchcraft can still bring punishment, but only if someone is accused of swindling credulous customers by pretending to have magical powers. So that's a really interesting and very gradual shift. I taught this book in a seminar last year, and the students were utterly fascinated by these structural contradictions that remain in place throughout the 18th century.
And if I could step in for a second, the ethnographic materials are in the trial records themselves. And so we have a contrast in the Ukrainian cases where most people accused of witchcraft are women. The majority are women. And that certainly is in concert with what was happening in much of Western Europe, although not all. The male witches that dominated in the Muscovite case, and we have feminization gradually occurring in the 18th and 19th centuries in Russia. We have examples of masculine or male witches in northern areas, some areas of France. So it's not peculiar to the Russian case, but that comes out very strongly. But the practices themselves, one scholar who I think reviewed Val's book on witchcraft in Muscovy made a comment that I thought was really interesting and speaks to the fact. And the comment was, this is the first time I've read in a book about witchcraft that the people who experienced it really believed in it. And no one would say that in the European case. And I was struck by that, because what we are dealing with is not a top-down witchcraft hunt. One had to, whether one was living in Ukrainian lands with different laws or in the Russian case with different laws, the petitions came from below. So people had to accuse others of witchcraft, and in their petitions and their accusations, you get details, ethnographic details. The ethnographic details come out in the actual trials, the incantations, but also descriptions of practices. And what is absent in the ethnographic material, and this is critical, that in both the Ukrainian and Russian cases, there are no witches' covens, there are no witches' sabbaths, no orgies with the devil, no devil's marks of unnatural teats, which pervade the European witchcraft ethnographic materials. And there are certainly evidence of those beliefs in Polish writings of the time. So those are absent. And instead, you know, we're dealing with, you know, incantations over hair, over bread that is then perceived to be dice. We're dealing with incantations that refer to the saints, to the Virgin Mary, to and the Mother of God, and to Christ, and to the Archangel Michael. They're infused with Christian elements, and they're frowned upon by the church because they're not said by clerics. And there's certainly a campaign beginning in the later 17th century and continuing in the 18th century to say, no, you know, non-clerics can't, you know, use this kind of language and so on. But the incantations also are full of nature. Mm-hmm. And they are so descriptive and so poetic that it's hard to sort of provide the beauty of them in many cases. We have to encourage our listeners to read these incantations, and students love them.
I know. I've given these to students, and you know, they read these Vorozhebnye Pisma, right? Like the witchcraft texts, and they're just they're just overwhelmed. And I guess, you know, this is a question for both of you. I would say, looking to future scholarship, I would love it if someone would kind of map out the texts using digital sources and sort of like locate the places where the accusations were made or where the trials were made. And that, you know, kind of brings me thinking about this as a source book to larger, bigger history and historiographical questions in the field. And this is for early modern Ukraine, for Poland, Lithuania, for Muscovy, for Imperial Russia, and so forth. I wonder if you could say a few words about this tradition of literacy and orality. And here, I guess, drawing from the magical writings, the very fact that they survive, as you point out, is quite remarkable, given the fact, without putting words in your mouth, that the clergy often were the people who were collecting them. But I wonder if, you know, again, like begging and treating your voice here as historians, if you could talk about the ramifications for the study of the politics of accusation and witchcraft in and beyond the 19th century, because after all, you've covered, my goodness, you know, you've covered 900 years. Who in the right mind would do that? But you did it. And you did it like really, really well, as a compliment. So I guess I would like to use some of this time to ask you about larger implications for how we as scholars might research these politics.
One of the things that struck me just as you were speaking, Stephen, is the fact that in the Ukrainian case, what we have are trial summaries, and they tend to be rather short. It's very rare to get into a much more detailed trial record, as a result of which we haven't been able to come across actual incantations. So that doesn't mean that they weren't used. So our historical record and the fact that in the Russian case we're finding things that weren't burned, like the incantations themselves, then this is a major problem for a historian, right? If you don't have the evidence, then it creates some problems. But we have enough, at least, that we feel comfortable enough in making generalizations. I think once you get past 1900, we sort of use 1900 as a cutoff, not to suggest that these ideas and practices about witchcraft suddenly died. They certainly didn't. We had materials that we could point to for example, newspaper reports in, and there was one in an Odessa court where a magician was brought in and was whispering in the back of the court incantations to help what must have been his client's case. And we thought, oh, we'd love to use this.
Wow.
But we started to get into the problem that we were using sources that we had basically not allowed for the rest. Obviously, newspapers are new media, but we hadn't used ethnographic materials. So we felt uncomfortable doing that. But we do talk about extra legal cases of witchcraft in particularly after emancipation in Imperial Russia, which would include the Ukrainian lands, where you have villagers taking into their own hands justice and sometimes attacking someone who was perceived to be a witch or sorcerer that was dangerous to the community or a stranger who came into their place, similar practices that they imposed on or against horse thieves. And that certainly continues into the 20th century. And we have a bit of a discussion of that. But, cursing is very common in both these cultures. And I think it's something that, that continues in Western European and other cultural societies after a period of supposed great secularization. So we have to understand these things and where they come from and what they mean and how their meanings change over time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Thank you. Val?
Yeah, I just add to that. It's easy for secularizing states to put an end to witchcraft trials. They can just not hear them in the courts anymore. They can take them off the book as a crime, as a criminal offense. Christine has a great article, actually, and I think we incorporated it in the book as well, on how in Russia it was actually a gradual decriminalization. But that's a pretty easy thing to do. It's much harder, of course, to eradicate witchcraft belief. And I think all of us who've spent time in the area know that it has been alive and well. And of course, it's alive and well in our society as well. Magic is pretty much impossible to eradicate. But I took it your question also sort of led us to the idea of witch hunts in the metaphorical sense.
I guess the politics of this, it really is. I'm giving you a loaded question, as I'm sure you realize, but go ahead.
Yeah. So it's a metaphor that has been much in vogue, especially thanks to our former president, who used the term, I don't know, when I checked last, it was something like 278 times. It's a term that has a lot of charge. And today, I think what it implies is unfair, baseless victimization. That it's a cry of the wronged, that this is a witch hunt against me. And there's nothing we can do about the way that term circulates in popular culture, but it clearly is a term that can be abused. So in American culture, when it's a man at the top of power who claims to be the victim of a witch hunt, you think about Salem, or you think about the cases that we're looking at, that is not the power dynamic that structures most witch hunts. And the power dynamic seems to me to be very important. It also, we use the term now because we don't believe witchcraft is real. So in its essence, it's a phony charge. But one of the things Christine just pointed out is people in the societies we're looking at believed this was a serious danger that they were terrified of. And while we have no sympathy for people who executed their neighbors on charges of witchcraft, we do take seriously the belief system in which it was embedded.
Yeah. And I just, go ahead, please.
Oh, I wanted to jump in just for a minute because I think it's really important to stress that in the Russian and Ukrainian cases involving witchcraft, in neither place witnessed the kinds of out of control witch crazes that took place in some areas of Europe. And we speculate in the book something that's really very important, that their shared orthodoxy, even though we have the Union of Brest in the Polish lands where Ukrainians lived, even though that went Catholic in terms of agreeing to the supremacy of the Pope, but retained Orthodox rite, witchcraft persecution was far less extensive and less lethal in comparison to many parts of Catholic and Protestant Europe. We don't have ecclesiastical officials developing the terrifying vision of heretical witches involved in a satanic conspiracy. And they didn't fixate on women's sexuality that fed into the European identification of women as witches. And furthermore, we have far by saying it's far less lethal, the 15% of cases in Muscovy from 1600 and then early modern Russian to the mid-1770s, only 15% of cases led to execution. In the Ukrainian areas, a mere 5% led to execution. That is not to say that there wasn't a lot of torture in both areas, and it's not to say that there wasn't trauma, anxiety, and so on the ground, but I think we have to, and one thing we were hoping to show that we have on the periphery a less dangerous kind of witchcraft, perhaps.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I guess, you know, one of the things that I would recommend to our readers, aside from reading all the book and all of the sources, is to pay very close attention to your focus on anthropology. This was something that really impressed me in the book, the anthropological perspective on witchcraft and sorcery and possession. And also, I would say, the other disciplines where we can then look at witchcraft perhaps not simply as a pre-modern phenomenon, but maybe even as a postmodern phenomenon in art history and philosophy and literature and performance studies. So I guess, you know, all the way to the end in your book, covering the work of Katerina Disa that you mention a lot in Ukrainian, as well as, you know, work on Guatemala and South Africa and Spain and other places. I think this is incredibly valuable for our readers, especially at this moment of war in Russia and Ukraine today. So my final question, just as a parting, and this is my word of gratitude and thank you for your time at this moment. If you would simply say in 1 minute what you might be interested in now or working on now, or if you'd like to suggest other readings for our students.
I'm always interested in witchcraft and magic, and I'm maintaining a sideline and working on the spells themselves, which, as Christine said, are just so transcendently beautiful and terrifying. But my actual project at the moment is working on questions of sovereignty, and just a paper I'm working on in Petrine, Russia, and thinking about sovereignty and the and territorial sovereignty of states and nations has taken on a whole new meaning in today's world. So I'm finding the horror of the moment has kind of electrified the work we do and made it all the more important to get some enlightenment on the subject.
I wouldn't disagree, really. Thank you. Christine?
I'm continuing to work on decriminalization as it was understood by Catherine the Great and the ramifications of that, which still allowed witchcraft to be adjudicated and prosecuted in courts until the mid-19th century and its complicated story. But most of my attention has been on two projects, one comparing pilgrimages of Russian Orthodox believers, regardless of their ethnicity, to sacred sites. And through the prism of individual monastic sites that drew pilgrims. And so I've worked extensively, for example, on the Pechersk'a Lavra in the 18th and 19th centuries. And I am now in contact with someone who's giving me a lot of information about Pochayiv, which is really interesting. And we, I have also interest in Solovki, Valam, obviously Holy Trinity, St. Sergius Monastery in Moscow. And pilgrimages have had a revival in this pre-war situation. The fact that Svyatogorsk was bombed the other day was horrifying to me, and to see the number of churches that have been bombed in Ukraine and the wholesale destruction is totally hypocritical on the part of the Russian authorities, where they're bombing their Orthodox parishes. And it's, of course, very disturbing. But beyond that, looking at, I have been doing a lot of work with the post-revolutionary situation in what became the Soviet Union, and that is how people practiced religion under an atheistic regime and the resistance to that atheism and the way it is so powerful. It's really just inspiring materials that I'm uncovering that people have not written about.
Yeah. Well, I think we are completely out of time here on the New Books Network. And I simply want to say thank you again at this really hard moment for joining me in a conversation about this book, Witchcraft in Russia and Ukraine, 1000 to 1900, a source book. It is edited by Valerie Kivelson and Christine Borovets, published by Cornell University Press, available 2020. It is also available in paperback. Thank you, Professors Kivelson and Borovets, really, for your time today. I'm so grateful.
Thank you so much.
Yes. Great talking with you.
Great talking to you.
And I'm your host here on New Books Russian and Eurasian Studies, New Books East European Studies, and New Books in Gender and Sexuality, podcast channels on the New Books Network. Stephen Siegel signing off. Until next time.